Does anybody have any question or comment they want to bring up on the previous lesson, Jeroboam? Everybody's happy with Jeroboam. Everybody except the Lord. Remember what I've asked you to do in this study. As a minimum, read the chapters that's on the schedule at the top of the lesson. Make sure you read that. And then the reading is a little slower because you notice there's some tough names in here. Okay, so who is the first king of Judah in the divided kingdom? Tough question. I'm not a lip reader. Rehoboam, okay? And now who is the second king? I'm not a lip reader. Second king. Okay. Abijah. Okay. And Abijah or Abijam, depending on which account you're reading it out of. Okay. So, now, who was the king of Israel that was the first king in the divided kingdom? Yeah. Jeroboam. And Jeroboam is still alive now. When Rehoboam dies and Abijah becomes king. How long does, it was in, I think, the, what year of Jeroboam's reign? 18th. And Abijah reigns for how long? 3 years. Okay. Now, notice, if you will, in, chapter, 1 Kings chapter 14. I'm sorry, not 14, 15. 1 Kings 15, chapter 3. It says, talking about Abijam, he walked in all the sins that his father did before him. And his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father. Now it goes down in verse 5 and it says, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and did not turn aside from anything that he commanded all the days of his life except in the manner of Uriah the Hittite. So the question I have, which I just read, is what is the sin of David that the writer refers to? That's the third question. And that would be what we just read, the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Okay. Now, one way you can look at this is you can say this is kind of summative. It stands for everything that David did in this regard. And that would be true. It's centered around Uriah. When you look at, and we're not going to turn back, but when you look back at 2 Samuel chapter 12 and verse 9, and it talks about where Nathan had come to David and brought to David's attention what he did, there what he referred to was his killing of Uriah with the sword and then the taking of Bathsheba to be his wife. The one thing that was missing was the sin of adultery. Was it still a sin, even though Nathan didn't mention it? Well, yes, it was. But Nathan didn't mention it. And in this case, Bathsheba is not mentioned, and the sin that David did against her is not mentioned. So, but there's one thing that I want us to keep in mind about the progressive nature of sin. I know we're not studying David, but we'll see this through the men of these in the time frame that we're studying. Sin has a progressive nature. What did David's sin lead to in the case of Bathsheba and Uriah? It started out with adultery. What did it lead to after that? Well, before that, when he was trying to trick Uriah, he used drunkenness, tried to get him drunk so that he would go home to his wife. So it progressed from adultery to trying to get a man drunk and then to murder. And then what did David do after that that God was not pleased with? He took Bathsheba to be his wife. Wasn't pleased with that either, you see. So the progressive nature of sin. Do you remember in the case of Abigail and her husband Nabal, when David and his men were fleeing from Saul, 1 Samuel 25, and And David's men had gone to Nabal to, you know, for food and nourishment. And Nabal said he had nothing to do with them. He refused it. David was going back out of vengeance to kill him. Who stopped him? The wife of Nabal, Abigail, you see. And so here again, you know, here was this vengeance, you know, going to lead to murder, you see. One sin leading to another. Now, can one sin lead to a sin that's even more heinous than the first sin? See, that's how it can grow, to become far more worse than it ever was to start with. Think of the lies that have been told, that if someone had just told the truth, it would have saved up all that was done to cover up lies. All kinds of, you know, unlawful, sinful acts to cover up, you know, what started out was just a simple lie that somebody just told the truth to start with. Pardon? It will sear your conscience. That's right. Now, let me ask you this, and this is three of question E. Can we foresee these subsequent sins? In other words, can we know the end from the beginning? Pardon? Okay. All right. Ennis, what were you saying? Pretty much same thing? Okay. All right. I want you to turn to Proverbs chapter 5. And let's look at the first five verses. And I'm just going to kind of read through these quickly. My son, be attentive to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding. This is Proverbs chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. My son, be attentive to my wisdom. Incline your ear to my understanding, that you may keep discretion, that your lips may guard knowledge. For the lips of a forbidden woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil, but in the end she is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword, her feet go down to death. Now, can you know the end from the beginning? Yes, you can. You can know where it's going to end up right from the beginning. So don't go there. Psalm 73 starts out as a question or a lack of understanding. Not so much a question, but a lack of understanding about the arrogant and the prosperous, and they seem to prosper. They seem to do well, and they don't seem to fall into the hardships of judgment, you know, that righteous people find themselves in. But notice what it says in verse 17. He says, he didn't understand this until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. You see, once he turned, like Toy said, it depends on how much we understand the Bible. Once you turn to the Scriptures and see what God has to say, then you can know the end. You can know the end of stomping your feet on others, taking advantage of others, mistreating others. You can know the end, you see, from the beginning. And it doesn't matter. It's true in our day, just like it was true when the psalmist wrote about it, and just like it was true in the life of David and the lives of these men that we're studying now. We can know the end if we choose to engage in sin. We can know how it's going to end up. So don't go there, because we've been warned about the end of it. Any comment or question? Yeah, arsenic builds up in you, doesn't it? It doesn't wash out, doesn't flush out. Yeah, you can take a little arsenic today, a little tomorrow, and it's going to build up and get you. Yeah. Okay. So then, where's the point that we stop sin? Where do you stop it? at the very beginning. Okay. If you go to James chapter 1 and verse 14, starting 14 and through 15, it's when that desire first comes into us that we need to put the stop. Because if we don't, and we let that desire, you know, get planted and then get nourished, then it's going to bear fruit. So the onset is when that desire first hits us. Don't need to play with it beyond that point. Need to put a stop to it right then. Because if we don't, it end up winning. Okay. There's an event that we're going to talk about now, and we'll turn to the Chronicles account, if you will. Let's go to 2 Chronicles chapter 13. 2 Chronicles 13. And this event is one that encompasses both Abijam as the king of Judah and Jeroboam as the king of Israel. We didn't discuss it under Jeroboam, but we're going to discuss it now under Abijah. Now, keep something in mind. The Chronicles accounts do not discuss the kings of Israel, only Judah. So when a king of Israel is mentioned in the Chronicles account, it's because of some direct influence upon the kingdom of Judah. This is one of those direct influences because it's a battle between the king of Judah and the king of Israel. But most of the kings that we're going to talk about in the study that are kings of Israel are not talked about in Chronicles. They're only talked about in Kings. So notice that in your reading. Okay. Now, it says here in this chapter that they go out to battle. And it's going to be a large battle because you can see there's well over 1 million soldiers involved in this battle. Now, what was this battle about? Okay. It says in verse 4 that Abijah stood up on the mountain, Mount Zemaraim, up in Ephraim, and he calls out to Jeroboam and to Israel. Now notice what he says in verse 5. Do you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the kingship over Israel forever to whom? Well, now, is that true? He did give it to David, right? David and his descendants. Okay, he did do that. But notice what he says now in verse 6 as he continues on. Yet Jeroboam, a servant of Solomon, who was the son of David, rose up and rebelled against his Lord. Is that true? Well, what's missing? Well, yeah, Solomon's the son of David, yeah. But what's missing in this? Yeah, it's not trying to say Jeroboam is the son of David. It's not saying that. At least I don't think so. Pardon? Well, it was not the acts of Rehoboam, it was the acts of Solomon. Yeah. Solomon, with Rehoboam, just crystallized it at a particular moment. It was already going to happen because of the prophecy given to Solomon that 10 tribes were going to be taken away. Rehoboam had nothing to do with that. He couldn't have saved that. He could save some other things, but not that. So what's missing here is that this was brought about by God. You see, the emphasis is not that that Jeroboam, you know, was rebellious against Rehoboam, but God brought it about. Now, he may have had worthless scandals in verse 7 that defied Rehoboam. That may have been true. And it talks about Rehoboam being young and soft of heart or timid. That seems to be true. He seemed to have the disposition of character not to be able to stand up to people and come up with his own course of action based on what he believed was right and do it. So that assessment of his own father seems to be correct. But now notice what he says in verse 8. And now you think to withstand the king of the Lord in the hand of the sons of David because you are a great multitude and have with you the golden calves. And talks about the things they've done as far as the priesthood and so forth that we discussed last week. But what's his message here? What's he trying to say? This is what the battle is about. He's trying to say to Jeroboam that you usurped this kingdom from Rehoboam. Does it belong to you? Never did belong to you. And I'm here to take it back. That's really what he was trying to do. Okay? So now he goes on to talk about what the priests under his reign do in verse 10. We have priests ministering to the law who are the sons of Aaron. Remember, there was anybody under Jeroboam. Didn't have to be sons of Aaron at all. They offer the Lord every morning, every evening, and he goes through what they do. God is at our head, and our priests with their battle trumpets to sound the battle call against you. Now, I don't think that in this, this is a real faith being expressed by Abijam. Okay. I think his faith was really a hypocritical faith, because when you go back and look at the summative statement of his rule, it was a wicked rule. He walked in the ways of his father. Well, what were the ways that his father walked in? Who set up male cult prostitutes, you see, and continued the worship of Solomon with the idols and so forth. Abijam continued in those very same things. So here on one hand, he's worshiping like his father Rehoboam and like his grandfather Solomon had done. On the other hand, he's claiming this righteousness before God. That's not righteousness as God looks at it. And God sums up his rule as a rule that was evil. So then what was the victory through? Because God gave him victory, but what was the victory through? That was in verse 18. What's the victory through? This is 2 Chronicles 13. Yeah, the men of Judah prevailed because they trusted in the Lord. I don't think it had anything to do with the faith or lack of faith of Abijam. It was what, you know, their faith. But what did God use this event for? See, in verse 20, Jeroboam did not recover his power in the days of Abijah, and the Lord struck him down, and he died. So you remember the prophet, the man that came out of Judah that we talked about last week. He had denounced the idol worship that Jeroboam set up, the system of worship that he set up. He denounced Jeroboam himself, that his family would be wiped out, and that prophecy was reiterated when Jeroboam's son got sick. We didn't discuss that point last week. And then thirdly, that even Israel itself would eventually go into captivity beyond the Euphrates, which is where Assyria carried the Israelites in 2 Kings 17 when they went into captivity. That all the places that the scriptures mention they went to are beyond the Euphrates. So fulfillment of what was given, the prophecies given to Jeroboam. So the striking down of Jeroboam was fulfillment of the prophecies that were given to him because of the way he went about setting up the kingdom and its system of worship. Any comment or question? I submit to you concerning Abijam that some things that he did not understand. One is he was similar to Jeroboam, the one he was fighting against and the one he was claiming, you know, was wrong in his worship. And he was wrong. That part, that is true. But he didn't understand himself how God was to be worshiped. Now, he wasn't worshiping the same way that Jeroboam was, but he didn't understand either. And it's not through our own devices that we're going to worship God, but it's in the way that God chooses. A second thing is God does not need us to do his planning. If God had wanted to remove Jeroboam from being king, he didn't need Abijam to take it on his own and go out and do it without a directive from God. Didn't need that at all. Abijam didn't go to God. If he was a man of God as he claimed to be, he would have gone to God. He didn't do that. So if that had been the case, God would have said no. Remember, God said no before. Remember, what was it that Nathan told David to do? And God came back to Nathan and said, nope. That's right. Sounded good. Sounded good to Nathan. Sounded good to David. David didn't like, you know, God not having his own temple. He had his own house. He didn't like God not having it. Sounds good. God said, no, it's not what I want. So God doesn't need us to do his planning. The restoration of Judah and Israel that Abijah was trying to bring on now was going to come how? Through Jesus Christ. That's how it was going to come. You see, not a reestablishment of this kingdom. I don't know what problems that would have caused when Christ came, had it been brought back together as one. No telling the problems that would have caused for Christ. It was difficult enough as it was with only a remnant coming back, because there was more than one occasion when Jesus had to leave the scene because they were trying to take him and force him to be king. We don't know the end from the beginning in those matters. We do in the matter of sin. But in the matter of what can sin bring on sometimes and some of the consequences specifically, we don't know these things. And then the loss of the 10 tribes was God's doing. It was not something that could be fixed by Abijam. Okay. Let's take a look at Asa, and we'll continue the discussion of Asa next week. We won't finish it tonight. Okay. Now, Asa also became king during the reign of Jeroboam. So it was after this battle with Jeroboam ended. Abijah died. Jeroboam is still alive. And then Asa becomes king in the 20th year. Jeroboam reigned 22, so he's got a couple of years left. And Asa reigned for a long time, 41 years. How is his service described? How does the writer of Kings describe it in the 1 Kings letter, the 15th chapter? How is his service before God described? Okay. He was described as a righteous king. Okay. Now, what does it say that he did that was right in the eyes of God? Verse 11, 1 Kings 15:11. Asa did right what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David his father had done. Now, what does it say that he did specifically? Okay. All right, you're in verse 12, right? Okay. All right. He took away what had been started by Rehoboam. Okay, and continued by Abijah. All right, what else did he do?
Took away the idols.
Took away the idols. Okay, what else? Yeah, he removed his mother from her position as queen mother. This is not a position I can say a whole lot about. We see it coming up later. Okay, with one, in the history, But evidently, the mother of the king held a prestigious position, and she was able to accomplish a lot of things, have a lot of influence. But in this case, what was her influence? It was bad, because she was doing what? She was making idols, worshiping the Asherah, okay? And so so Asa cut down her image and burned her image at the brook and removed her from being the queen mother. So now when Jesus makes a statement that he who loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me, what does that say about Asa? He loved God more than he loved his mother, okay? Now, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but what I'm looking at is what made his heart this way. Why was God able to say this about him? Holy true, my version reads, perfect, the version she's reading uses. You see, it's that he, his own family, his own mother, was less important to him. And he was so committed to this honoring God. Now, what does verse 14 say? Okay. Nevertheless, his heart was perfect, a holy true to the Lord all of his days. So what does it mean to say he didn't take away all of the high places? What does that mean? Okay. I'll have a handout in the next class or two on the high places and the green trees and such stuff as that, kind of a summative handout. But it was common among the Canaanite nations that they would go up on the hills and they would mount a place to offer their sacrifices. You'll see terms used like pillars and poles. And they would set up these pillars and poles as a part of their worship to these idols. So they would build an altar there. And these would be used in their worship. Well, if we turn back to Exodus, let's go to the giving of the Ten Commandments. He says in verse 2, Exodus 20, Exodus 20, verse 2, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. Now notice what he says in verse 4. You shall not make yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or is in earth beneath or is in water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. Now, can we make an image that looks like God? Why not? We don't know what it looks like. So if we're going to make an image, it's going to have to be of something that God has created. It's going to have to be of something in his creation, because we don't know what God looks like. And he says here, not to make a carved image or any likeness of anything, you see, and worship that. Well, this is what the Israelites would do. Now, we see in some cases where they would bow down to these false idols, you know, the kings would set up and such as that, the Asherah and so forth. But they would also worship Jehovah God through these images that they've set up. So they're also claiming to worship God in the high places and under the green trees, you see. And God's not pleased with that. They're violating what he said that they should not do, not to set up these false images. So they're setting these things up and they're worshiping God in a way that he's not authorized. So it may be that in 14, what's not taken away, is these images that were set up to worship Jehovah God. Whereas the images that were taken up to worship the idolatrous gods were taken away. That may be what was not taken away. Because when we go to the Chronicles account, and we notice in chapter 14 and verse 3, if you'll turn there, 2 Chronicles 14 and 3. It says here that he took away the foreign altars and the high places and broke down the pillars and cut down the Asherim. Now my version uses foreign altars. What do the other versions use? What does the New American Standard use? Foreign? Okay. So it may be that the idea of foreign is looking to the idols that were set up to serve these false gods. And so those things he took away. Then you go over to 15. And in verse 8, you see, he put away the detestable idols from the land of Judah and Benjamin. And from the cities in the hill country. So he did it not only in the land of Judah and Benjamin and from the cities that he had taken the hill country of Ephraim. He went up into the land of Judah and did it. You go on down to verse 17. But the high places were not taken out of Israel. So again, we see that bringing these accounts together, some of these he took out, some he left. It's maybe the ones he left were the ones that had been devoted to Yahweh or Jehovah God. And tore out the others. But God was pleased with what he had done, that he had done as much as he had done. Could he have done more? Yeah. Because you look at the way it's worded in chapter 15 and verse 17 of 2 Chronicles. But the high places were not taken out of Israel. Nevertheless, or in spite of this, the heart of Asa was wholly true all of his days. So God was pleased with what he had done. Any question or comment on this aspect of the study?
We could take an example from this in nowadays terms with how people have the depiction of Jesus.
Okay.
Pictures of Jesus. It's like they're trying to carve an image of Jesus and God in a picture.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's all sorts of ways it shows up. The pictures are one thing. The necklaces that people wear are another thing. I remember many years ago a young man that was converted to Christ. But his pride and joy after he was converted was he went out and brought this humongous cross. It must have been about 6 inches long and about 3 inches wide. And we picked him up one morning to take him to service. And he was so proud of that. He was showing it to us. And so just right there on the spot, you know, we brought up, that's not the way we worship God. He hated to hear that. But he took that cross off and I never saw it again. The wood of the cross. You see what an issue it is among people today, wanting a piece of that wood. But it's gotten further than that. It's being said now because there are certain ones claiming that we're close to finding the Noah's Ark. And it's being said that, you know, the question comes up, well, how's that going to help us? You know, that's not the Word of God. How's that going to help us? Well, the word that even Christians are putting out is that, yeah, we've got that piece of wood now. We've got that wood of the Ark. And with that, we can convince the critics. What did Jesus say about that in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus? Even if a man is raised from the dead. So if you're not going to believe a resurrection, then who's going to believe a piece of wood no matter where it came from? There's nothing that replaces the Scriptures. There's nothing that replaces the Word of God. And and all the pictures on the wall, all the things we might wear on our neck, there's nothing about those things that bring us closer to God. Colossians chapter 2 kind of sums up some things. At the close of Colossians chapter 2, and we refer to this passage from the concept of angels in last week's study. And that's where the man from Judah was interceded with by the old prophet from Bethel. And the prophet from Bethel, the old prophet, told him that an angel had brought the word of God to him, and he was supposed to come and have dinner with him, you see, eat food with him. And he, of course, he lied. And people put credence to what an angel says. You see, that's an angel. That's important. Notice what's said in Colossians chapter 2, verse 23. All these things, do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, all of these things that you want to talk about. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom, promoting self-made religion, asceticism, severity of the body, but they have no value toward what? Fleshly indulgence. They're worthless, you see. These things are empty. And so our faith comes by studying and studying the Word of God. Okay. I'm sorry? Galatians chapter 1. That's correct. Basically, it became an idol that flourished in Judah, Israel, for several hundred years. King Hezekiah broke it into pieces. Anybody remember what it is?
It was the serpent, wasn't it?
That's right. All the days from the wilderness wandering, the Jews had kept that bronze serpent and they'd made an idol out of it. They'd worshipped it. Hezekiah, many, many years later, took it and just broke it to pieces. So, has nothing to do with honoring God. It has nothing to do with the indulgences of the flesh. Any other comment? Let's make a comparison here. We've got about 3 minutes left. Let's make a comparison between Abijah and Asa. Asa was evil. Abijah was good. The father, son.
Asa was bad? Is that what you said?
If I did, I said it wrong.
I think you said it wrong.
Abijah was evil. Asa was good. Okay. All right. So, sometimes we think that the son is going to be like the father because he grew up around the father. He's got the influence of the father. And so we tend to think that's how he's going to be. There's a warning in 1 Corinthians 15:33. What's that warning? Bad company corrupts good morals. And so the warning is that we can become like the people that we hang around with, that we associate with. So we need to be on our guard. Obviously, we're in the world. And Jesus says, we're in the world, but we're not to be of the world. So being in the world, we're going to be exposed to evil influences. but we're just not to participate in those things. So, how is it that a man like Asa can reject the ways of his father? Okay. 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 Okay.
The same way that Hezekiah was one of the best kings of Israel, of the divided kingdom, God gave him 20 years extra of life.
15.
His son became king after him, Manasseh, one of the worst kings of Israel, at Judah. He was born during that extra period that God granted. But Manasseh's grandson was another one of the best kings. Josiah.
Yeah.
There's no accounting.
Well, there is, but we'll look at that more. We'll look at it. But the comments I've made have been good and right. Free moral agency can see the problems that their father ran into. But we'll see in so many cases that didn't work. You know? So it's a point for us to think a little bit more about. Thanks. We'll be on the same lesson next week or Sunday.